Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. With me today, we have Kathy Wood, our hero and savior, CIO and CEO of ARK, and Sean McClain, returning champion. Sean, welcome back to the pod. Sean is the co-founder and CEO of Absci. Sean, remind us, what is Absci? What are you doing? Tell us about AI, drug discovery, and drug development, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for having us on for a third time. So we are a generative drug design company. We are using generative AI to actually design molecules, in our case, antibodies to some of the hardest drug targets that are out there. And I think if you look at, you know, what AI is doing in general, it's, you know, making things, you know, faster, better, cheaper. But one of the pieces that, you know, generative design within drug discovery allows us to do is actually open up this fourth dimension, which is going after new novel biology, being able to go after biology that has previously been undruggable. And we've been able to actually show success with some of these targets in partnerships. One of them was in partnership with Caltech. There was this, Caltech had made this really great discovery where they found this a highly conserved region in the HIV virus called the Caldera region. And no one had actually figured out how to drug that because it was this very deep crevice and our own immune system couldn't figure out a way to drug it. Humans couldn't figure out. But we were able to actually use our AI technology to design an antibody that could bind deep within inside that crevice, potentially leading to a neutralizing antibody to all clades of HIV, which no one had ever done before. And I think another like prime example of this is in our partnership with Almirall. There is this particular ion channel for dermatological diseases. And this ion channel had been known for 30 plus years. And everyone has, you know, been figuring out ways to block this particular ion channel. And we're able to, again, use this generative design platform to actually design an antibody for the first time ever that could actually block this ion channel. And, you know, these are just some of the, kind of, you know, some of the proof points that we've seen already in kind of unlocking this new novel biology, kind of in addition to making things, you know, faster, cheaper, and better.
Sean, just on that last point, the ion channel, many people who are going to be listening to this would like to know your ability to do that, to block that. Who did that help? Who did that benefit?
So I can't necessarily dive into that particular program just due to confidentiality, but I'll paint a picture on a different ion channel, which is a potassium ion channel, KV1.7 and 1.8. And this is a well-known ion channel in pain. And there's actually great human genetics data out there that individuals that have these ion channels knocked out don't feel pain. I'm sure that you know, you've heard of the firewalkers in, you know, Southeast Asia. And the idea is if you can actually block this particular ion channel, you would actually eliminate pain and you would actually have a non-addictive pain medication that isn't opioid driven. And for us, these are kind of the hard, challenging, you know, problems that we want to solve. And so that's kind of to give an example of, you know, in this case, an ion channel actually regulates pain.
And on the HIV side, potentially, this would provide the fuel for a potential HIV vaccine that would be universally useful.
Yeah, that'd be universally useful across all the different variants of HIV that exist. Today, it's always been hard to drug the virus because it's so rapidly changing and evolving. And the discovery that Caltech made was this highly conserved region that doesn't change from, you know, the different HIV viruses that evolve over time. And so if you're able to actually target that, then you could essentially wipe out all the different variants of HIV. And again, no one actually had, you know, figured out how to necessarily go about finding a vaccine in this particular way.
So these are huge markets. How long? So you've seen success. How long in terms of research? Are we looking at, 6 years, 13 years? How long before we would see something on the market?
To talk about, you know, how quickly we can, you know, use generative design to actually get to a, you know, phase two proof of concept in humans, I'll focus in on ABS-201. So this is an antibody that we are developing towards the prolactin receptor. And this is a really cool mechanism for hair regrowth. And essentially what we've found is that if you're able to block the prolactin receptor, you can shunt the follicle from this essentially dormant phase where you get apoptosis and regression and the hair no longer, you know, grows, to actually shunting the follicle back into the anagen state or this active growth state. And this is, you know, this would essentially be able to, you know, regrow hair as well as repigmentation. And, you know, we started on this program roughly, you know, 2 to 2.5 years ago. And from, you know, start of the program to our phase two proof of concept readout next year in humans will be roughly 3.5 years to get to a phase two proof of concept readout. This is truly, you know, unheard of. I mean, normally it takes three and a half to five years just to get one drug in the clinic. And then, you know, it takes years after that to then get a proof of concept readout. And, you know, not only were we able to do it in 3.5 years, but we were also able to do it with a $15 million investment, where normally it takes $50 to $100 million just to get it into the clinic, and then billions to actually develop it once it's in the clinic.
That's pretty wild. I know I backed into that question, but we really wanted to talk a little more about AI. Am I right?
No, that's fine. I mean, one, let's just stop there for a second. Hair loss is actually your hair follicles just falling asleep, right? Basically, they just like fall asleep. And this is like, you know, you plug in kind of like into an electric socket in the cell, like, wake up, you know, and then it wakes up and keeps growing, or that's the promise. And it's very different from a Rogaine or, you know, the existing treatments on market, which aren't like precise keys that plug into the cell.
Exactly. It's actually regenerative biology. So essentially what ends up happening is you get prolactinemia on the scalp, essentially a buildup of prolactin. And that essentially drives the follicle into that catagen state, again, where you get the apoptosis and regression. And the stem cell is no longer active. And the follicle itself is, as you mentioned, Brett, essentially dormant. And by blocking the prolactin receptor, we're actually re-stimulating the stem cell growth and actually allowing that follicle that's existing to start to grow hair again, as well as to actually get pigmentation back as well. And, you know, these are kind of some of the exciting themes that, you know, we have within our portfolio is focused kind of on this regenerative biology, where we can actually figure out how to reverse some of the damage that has been caused by us just aging.
May I just ask one quick question on that? How did you happen upon that particular application? What did you back into it? Was it, we're going after this?
This was actually discovered by our chief innovation officer, Andreas Busch, who was the CSO at Bayer. And, you know, AI in this case cannot take credit. This was a total serendipitous discovery. Bayer was actually looking at the prolactin receptor for endometriosis. And when they ran the animal studies, they actually saw the mice that were on the drug regrew their hair faster than the control arm. And that led them to then dive in and figure out that actually the prolactin receptor is not only involved in endometriosis, but is involved in the hair regrowth. And yeah, and so essentially Andreas took that knowledge to Absci, and then we used our generative design platform to design kind of the best antibody to ultimately address that particular target and be able to actually see this biological pathway come to fruition in patients.
And Bayer didn't pursue it in part because they couldn't find something that efficiently plugged in. Right.
Exactly. They developed an antibody, but it wasn't commercially viable. So in order to get the efficacy that was seen in the stumptail macaques, which, you know, completely regrew their hair, they were going to have to dose 24 injections over a 6 month period versus, you know, we're going to be, you know, dosing every 2 to 3 times over that 6 month period. And so being an out of pocket, you know, cash pay, you know, product that just ultimately wasn't going to scale. And so we were actually able to develop a drug that could be, you know, at a price point that would be commercially viable.
That's like the key. If you imagine, so we've done modeling on AI impact on drug discovery. We think you can, you know, over time shrink time to market and shrink your cost to get to market in aggregate. Right now, from the likes of you all, there's pretty good evidence that the pre-discovery, everything up to the clinic, can be done more efficiently. You can get into the clinic more quickly. You can do it more capital efficiently. And then there's an open question, because most of the AI developed drugs are not yet commercialized. It's once you're in the clinic, are you going to be able to be more efficacious there so you have a better odds of getting all the way through?
Well, in this particular one, is the question, wait a minute, either the hair grows in back with pigment or it doesn't. And, you know, is that efficacy, will it be determined in phase two, and you don't need to go to phase three? Do you cut that out?
Yeah. So the great part about this is that we're actually able to run a combined phase one, phase two trial, where we're going to be able to look at both safety as well as hair regrowth. And since, you know, most of the, you know, individuals that have, you know, AGA or androgenic alopecia are, you know, healthy individuals, we essentially can, you know, run a combined phase two or phase one, phase two study, looking again, both at safety and hair regrowth. And then we would then run a pivotal study after that. And the great news is that if the readout looks good next year, we will be filing our BLA with the FDA and seeking approval around 2030. And so that's actually from a time to market, that's actually a very, very quick turnaround time. And again, I think it really goes to show that the, you know, how AI can ultimately kind of collapse overall timelines and increase overall success.
Yeah. So Brett has led our research on how much AI will be able to shrink the time. And I think if you're successful on this, our research is spot on, because we've said the average time for a drug up to now without AI has been 13 years. You're saying about 8 years. Am I right? 7 or 8 years?
Yeah, seven or eight years. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been projecting that by 2030. So bravo, Brett.
Oh, yeah.
Let's not judge it based on one drug, but
Okay. It's
I'll take the win. Sure.
Yes, yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
It is really exciting. This will be one of the first AI designed antibodies that will have a phase two efficacy readout. And so this will be one of the first of its kind. And so we're really excited. I mean, not only for the readout, you know, for the drug for patients, but also I think a really monumental time for AI to drug discovery as well.
One last question, and this again is back to the research. We have said that if you include failures, the average cost to bring a drug from discovery to market today is about $2.4 billion. How much do you think taking this drug to market will cost you?
It'll be a fraction of that. I mean, if I look at the you know total investment, it's easily going to be $100 to $150 million, you know, to ultimately get approval on this. So, you know, a fraction of that, you know, $2 billion.
Of course, that's conditional on success. So the, you know, again, don't judge based on one drug. It could be that Sean and Avsai are just very good.
I know, but I'm just trying to help people understand what we think the possibilities are. Here's, you know, this may actually fit into our 8 years. Now, our cost estimate is $600 million per drug, including failures. So, you know, if you skipped a beat along the way, it could be as much as that. But if not, oh my gosh, that's unbelievably good.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What's interesting about drug discovery to me is like, not only can you potentially shrink time preclinically or, you know, discovery, et cetera, and, you know, if you get to market with just a key that plugs in more with a tighter coupling to the lock, then you don't have to give the patients as many doses. So, you know, an injection every 2 to 3 months, as opposed to, it sounded like an injection every week
almost
or something.
Every week to 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah. And it means that kind of the potential for any kind of like toxicity effects are lowered because you're able to give a lower dose and still like tightly couple, and it's not going to plug in anywhere else. This is a key made just for this lock. And so then, you know, no matter the disease, it could be hair loss, it could be whatever, the promise is that then these really are precision medicines, whereas before we were kind of relying on kind of random walk through nature to like find the way in which the thing fit.
Yeah, 100%. You kind of hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I like to say that, you know, we've really gone from now this paradigm of searching for the needle in the haystack to actually being able to create the needle. In our case, it's an antibody-based drug, but we can now actually start to test hypotheses that weren't possible. Yeah, you can actually start to engineer in the features that you want, bind in the tumor microenvironment in acidic pH, but, you know, don't bind in healthy tissues, activate this pathway, block this pathway. And you can really have that precision when you're going about, you know, drug discovery. And it also allows you to fail faster. If you can actually quickly and rapidly test these hypotheses and figure out which of these, you know, actually have, you know, legs, or, you know, which of them you should, you know, kill, and, you know, the biology, you know, didn't pan out. That's hugely valuable. And I think that's, you know, what I think a lot of times is overlooked is that ability to fail faster and have that learning loop dramatically decrease. Because, you know, the shorter that learning loop is, you know, the faster we're going to and more cost effectively we're going to be able to you know, get these drugs to patients.
You're going to the chip companies, and we're struck that, you know, that both NVIDIA and AMD understand the promise here and want to be a big part of unlocking the secrets of life, health, and death, and so forth. So I know AMD invested in Absci and NVIDIA and Recursion. So maybe you can talk about that a little bit, how that happened and the similarities or differences between the two of you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, with NVIDIA investing in Recursion and AMD and investing in Absci, it really goes to show how, you know, deeply committed, you know, these chip manufacturers are to, you know, healthcare and life sciences, and not only committed, but I think actually see, you know, massive upside and potential. And I think it's, you know, both, you know, AMD and NVIDIA, I think really have the vision that healthcare could be, you know, the the next kind of big unlock for them. And, you know, the compute utilizations that, you know, they're going to see, I think, are going to be astronomic, you know, relative to others, just because of the complexity of biology. It's so complex, and it's kind of like the perfect use case for AI and deep learning. And, you know, we've had partnerships with both, you know, in NVIDIA and now AMD. AMD, you know, earlier this year made, you know, an investment in Absci. And one of the reasons we decided to partner with AMD was, you know, one, how committed they were to the overall space. But the interesting part to us was actually the chips themselves and the higher memory that they had. The fact that these chips had higher memory meant that we weren't going to have to crop the input to the model. And so essentially, you know, we're training on structures and protein sequences. And by cropping them, we're only putting in a fraction of the overall, you know, target structure. You're getting limited information. But if you have more memory, you can actually train on the whole structure of the target or protein, which enables you to ultimately have, you know, a higher fidelity and more accurate model. You're just essentially being able to get more information into that model. And so we saw that as, you know, really exciting from, you know, a training perspective. We're excited to be partnering with both of them. And ultimately, we see them being able to kind of, at least AMD being able to unlock new kind of features, but also drive down our overall costs as well on the training side.
If you look at your chip and your chip utilization, is it right to think of like, hey, I'm devoting some of this to training and some of this to inference? In your data center, how is that working and how does that trade-off occur?
Yeah, since we're an R&D shop, we're still, I would say, predominantly on the training side, but we are seeing more and more ultimately going to inference. And, you know, inference costs are increasing. I think that's another area where, you know, we see the AMD, you know, chips being, you know, very efficient on the inference side of things. And we do see that being more and more important moving forward. But I would say, you know, predominantly it is training with a, you know, a decent chunk going into inference and really trying to drive down those inference costs with the AMD platform.
Tell me about the data mix, what you're feeding into the model, and then kind of like what's the equivalent of a prompt for the inference engine on the back end? Yeah, how does this all work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're really working with like multimodal models. So, you know, we're training on, you know, the structure of proteins. We're also training on the sequence of antibodies and then the overall affinity to a particular target of interest. And then we're also, you know, training on, you know, various developability parameters. You know, is this, you know, particular molecule going to be minimal for manufacturing? Can we get, you know, high titers with this? Is it going to have good solubility? Is it going to be, you know, have low cross reactivity with other proteins? And, you know, is it going to have a low immunogenicity profile? And so these are kind of all the different data points that we're putting into the model. And when you look at the prompt, you know, essentially what we're, you know, inferencing on is, you know, taking the, you know, let's say the Caldera region of the HIV virus, going back to the HIV case study, we're essentially taking that known structure, we're telling the model, we want to generate an antibody that will bind to this particular area of the target, which is called the epitope. And the model then is going to design essentially the fingers of the antibody that are able to then bind to that particular target of interest. So, you know, essentially going kind of to your lock and key analogy, we're essentially, you know, giving the model the lock, and then it's designing the key to fit in appropriately to ultimately give us kind of that biology that we're looking for. And not only is it designing the molecule to bind to that target, but it's also taking into account, again, all of these developability parameters, because it's not about just making sure that you have a potent, you know, efficacious antibody. You also need to make sure that it doesn't react with the immune system and have, you know, a tox effect in the clinic. You need to make sure that you can manufacture it cost effectively. And so there's all these other parameters that are really important that the model takes into account as well when designing these particular drug antibodies.
May I ask just one more question on the AI? It seems to me that the two chip makers, the largest ones, have chosen you and Recursion. I think, they haven't invested, to my knowledge, Brett, do you know, in any other? So it really puts you in a very interesting and special position, I think. Am I right on that?
Yeah, from a public standpoint, I think, us and Recursion, I think are the, you know, only public investments that they've made. I think, you know, where, you know, you are seeing, you know, in NVIDIA and AMD, yeah, I think invest in a lot of the, you know, startups in the space. But in terms of, you know, public companies, you know, really, I think the only two investments that they've made.
Very interesting.
Yeah, biological data is like truly astronomically big data. Strategically, they definitely, if you imagine chips are just a mechanism for like bulk processing, like, you know, large volumes of data. Well, here we are just scratching the surface on understanding biological systems. And there's so much to kind of like unpack and throw into those chips.
In helping people understand that, you know, who are trying to understand, wait a minute, how are these two spaces coming together? 35 to 40 trillion cells in our body is all I have to say. And you know, largest data project, most important source of proprietary data, I think, most profound application of AI.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that is important to recognize is that we have kind of taken all of the low-hanging fruit that's out there of the available data. And I think we've done a pretty good job of figuring out how we can utilize that data in both drug discovery and clinical development. But we are starting to reach a point in time where we do need to generate new data to train these models. And, you know, one area that we kind of think of is like the translatability. So, you know, right now we're designing the molecule again with a hypothesis in mind. But the next step would be, okay, how can we, you know, use an AI model to actually predict how that molecule is going to behave in humans to ultimately kind of, you know, reduce, you know, the overall cost of failure and making sure that everything we take forward is going to have the highest success possible. And we're missing the data, that translatability data, to actually make these models. And it's difficult because you have to generate it from, you know, both animal data as well as, you know, human data, and there's limited data there. And so how do we go about generating kind of these key pieces of data to ultimately, I think, get some of these important models designed of the future? And so that's kind of an exciting piece that we're looking at is figuring out how we can create new technology and then use, you know, existing kind of simulation data to ultimately create the data package that's going to be needed for these AI models.
Can I just ask one question on the animal testing and animal research? I think that the FDA is saying now no more need for animal testing for monoclonal antibodies, and that may be more. Is that going to change anything for you?
Oh, so we love the fact that the FDA came out with guidance that said they ultimately want to replace animal models with AI models. And that is the direction that we are headed. There's, you know, steps that we need to take in order to get there. I think, you know, another piece is, you know, how can we create AI models that can, you know, predict immunogenicity and how it's going to ultimately behave from a safety and tox perspective. And then there's actually predicting how efficacious is the drug going to be? Is the biology viable? And those are kind of like the two different paths that, you know, the FDA is wanting us to go. And again, for us to get there, we're going to need to continue to generate new data in order to enable that. But the fact that the FDA wants to go that direction is extremely positive, because that ultimately is it's what's going to, you know, streamline and, you know, make, you know, drug discovery and development a lot more cost effective.
It's becoming AI centric as an organization, it seems to us. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's really great to see.
And one of the ways I think about it, and actually this will kind of segue into the longevity discussion a little bit, but we, you know, there's this idea that there's, I think it's maybe 7,000 diseases. There's not 7,000 diseases. There are many, many more. You know, I don't know about orders of magnitudes more, but at least 20,000, because that's how many genes you have. But really, like practically, you know, each individual, like every cancer is its own unique disease. We are suffering from a huge dearth of precision medicine, obviously, because we have only diagnosed 7,000 diseases. There's so much work that could be done to like actually, you know, create the puzzle pieces that help our body function better.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you can actually increase the probability of success and decrease the overall costs, you can actually start to go after smaller and smaller patient populations until you get to the point of individualized medicine. But first, we need to show you can increase that success rate, because that drives a ton of, you know, overall costs. And, you know, that, you know, will truly, I think, drive down the cost to, you know, start to look at smaller and smaller populations. And then again, going to that individual.
Right. And that's like, the stage we're at now is very much the, okay, prove to me that it works story. You know, you can, and having proven that it works, that will attract a lot of capital, because kind of the apparent RO return on R&D could be very high. I mean, we think it could be in kind of like more technology landscape rather than traditional drug discovery, which has been a horrific use of like equity risk capital over the past decade, you know. Getting 4% returns, I'd rather be in cash, right? The promise of AI drug discovery is you can do, you know, 20%+ returns on R&D and then just like massively expand the target set you're going after.
Before we go into longevity, Brett, maybe we can stop right there. And we have, over the last 4 to 5 years, it's been very tough in this space. And I mean, we have been calling this, and we truly believe that, you know, healthcare is the most profound application of AI brewing out there. And we've gotten validation with NVIDIA and AMD buying into this space. And you're right, a lot of that in the activity increasingly in the private markets. Why do you think, as you are talking to analysts, let's say in the public markets, are you getting questions that help you understand the misperceptions out there, or is the time horizon just too long and they're hiding behind higher interest rates or whatever other excuse the macros are throwing at them?
You're completely right. I mean, it's been 5 years of, you know, a biotech nuclear winter. And I do think that, you know, spring is coming. I think, you know, not only for, you know, biotech, but I think, you know, AI drug discovery and we are seeing a lot of interest pick up. I think one of the big pieces that investors and analysts, you know, want to see is that, look, we hear you that it can be, you know, better, faster, and cheaper, and there's a chance that, you know, you can, you know, lower overall success rates. It's great that you've shown it, you know, preclinically, but we want to see, you know, this be actually, you know, efficacious in humans and actually translate, have that preclinical data translate into humans. And so I think we do have a lot of, I think, exciting wins that are going to be, you know, put on the board. I think, you know, you have in silico's readout coming up, you have Recursion's, you know, readouts that are coming, you have ours that are going to be, you know, next year. And so we're going to have, I think, a whole slew of, you know, phase two proof of concept catalysts coming out that I think will be really strong proof points to show how AI is really shaping drug development, and that we are able to start to use AI to unlock novel biology that's going to, you know, ultimately be beneficial to patients. But I do see the turn in the market and interest rates, you know, coming down, or I definitely think are going to, you know, help in this space, I think.
Yeah, but even so, if you look at interest rates, they peaked. Well, I guess it was short rates. Long rates peaked in 2023, and still, I think, you know, the lack of M&A, lack of strategic price discovery, just put the kibosh, you know, and EBITDA losses, even as rates were starting to come down, most time horizons, it seemed to us, had collapsed, and that's changing. I just want to, in the last answer, you said lower success rates. I know you meant lower failure rates.
Yes, lower failure rates. Thank you for the correction on that, Kathy.
Yeah. There is an interesting intersection. Well, one, there's one thing that people say as we're constructing like our total forecast. They're like, well, okay, you expect there to be an inflection and basically spend for medicine as medicine becomes more precise. And it's like, well, where does that come from? One place it can come from is inefficient spend for existing healthcare stuff. If you have a hair loss drug in market, actually you can displace non-insured spend, which is somebody paying for a hair transplant. Instead, they can take a drug, and that's actually could be a lot, you know, less expensive and more, you know, you don't have to wear a hat for 6 months or whatever and go through a surgery. Do you think kind of that drug and then other drugs that you potentially have in discovery will be more of this kind of like consumer driven marketing action that's, and maybe longevity generally has to move in that direction?
Absolutely. I think, you know, some of the things that we are working on that I think can definitely be consumer focused would be in, you know, looking at like sarcopenia for example. So essentially muscle wasting. So, you know, as you age, once you hit about 40, you lose your 1-2% of both muscle mass as well as strength. And by the time you hit, 50 to 60, you know, that can get upwards of 3% in overall muscle and strength degradation. And
per year.
That's pretty wild. No wonder I'm training so much.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do some leg lifts as you're talking. Just keep going.
Yeah. The craziest part is, like, you know, you look at hip fractures and, you know, in the elderly, 15-30% of those that ultimately sustain a hip fracture have a one-year mortality rate. And it really just goes to show how important overall, you know, strength is for ultimately preventing, you know, very deathly falls. And so we are working on a drug right now, or a target that's actually known for longevity. This particular target has been actually shown to increase the lifespan of mice by 25%. There's a lot of various other kind of longevity targets you can go after, but we felt like being able to go after sarcopenia and being able to show that you could increase overall strength would be a great initial indication. And then you could ultimately use this in a lot of other, you know, indications that are within longevity and kind of along this idea of being able to kind of reverse the damage that biology has, you know, ultimately accrued on us as we've aged.
Could that be an insured drug going against sarcopenia, maybe defined to some subpopulation? It could.
Yes, we think that this could definitely be you know, both out of pocket, but also insured as well. And I think different, you know, other indications I think could be out of pocket as well, you know, depending on how the doctor, you know, wants to ultimately prescribe it.
Because it is interesting to think some of these drugs, for instance, sarcopenia, it's like you could imagine an insurer will look at it and be like, well, this person only becomes at risk of falling and breaking their hip at the age of 74. So we're going to allow it to be underwritten there. But here I am, I'm like, well, I don't want to lose 3% of my muscle mass.
Exactly.
I want to be good at tennis, right? So I'm willing, you know, you're trying to avoid me breaking my hip 20 years from now. I'm trying to avoid me like losing some speed on my serve, you know, so I'm willing to kind of pay to avoid the disutility of aging. And potentially that becomes like actually a bigger driver of the market. If we're in a world of abundance, if we have humanoid robots taking out the trash for us, we're riding around inexpensively in robo-taxis, we have all this consumer surplus, what are we going to spend it on? It's, I want to live forever. I'm going to spend all of my money trying to live forever. That's the the promise here.
And there's another thing. You've got the GLP-1s, those that accelerate the muscle degradation,
that's
right?
And it actually causes balding as well, which is really interesting.
Oh, wow. You're going to be an antidote to all of the problems that GLP-1s. They do a great number of good things, but there are side effects. Yeah.
It goes to show you that the consumer is actually willing to your point, Brett, to actually pay for medicine that is, you know, potentially going to make them, you know, live longer and healthier and is like more preventative in nature. And it's going to be a really interesting question on how, you know, insurers, you know, approach this. Cause I think, you know, that's where we see things headed is, you know, being able to prevent, you know, let's say the four horsemen from occurring, which, you know, is cancer, any neurodegeneration disease, metabolic dysfunction disease, such as, you know, diabetes, as well as cancer. And if you can essentially, you know, prevent those from occurring, you can ultimately save a lot of capital in the long term. But is in, you know, are the insurance companies actually going to pay for that upfront if you can actually, you know, show you can, you know, prevent, you know, muscle wasting, you can prevent cancer, so on and so forth. And so it's going to be interesting to kind of see how, you know, insurance approaches this and are we going to be going direct to consumer on this? And is the consumer, you know, willing to pay for it? And from what we're seeing, I think some of these, I think the answer is yes, the consumer will ultimately pay for it.
Right. I mean, there is like this principal agent problem in that insurers have patients on plan for an average of 4 years, but patients live longer than, I mean, hopefully live longer than 4 years, right? And so if you're promising something that actually will extend their life on the back end, it's like, well, why am I on the hook for this now? Wait till you're about to die, then you can come to me, you know? And so it definitely misaligns kind of like the commercial incentives in the market. And again, it kind of biases people towards sick care. It's like, find the deathly sick patients and extend their life by 3 months. And rather than be like, let's extend everybody's life, you know, by, you know, a couple of years with something.
We've been doing some research on this. You know, prescriptions or therapies, less than 10% of the healthcare budget, which is closing in on 20% of GDP, change that 90%, shift it more towards therapies. And as we prevent, you know, preventative medicine and cures, we think will take share from the sick care. And it's in the insurance company's interest to do so.
Yeah. I mean, the expense that, you know, is accrued in the hospital and, you know, the last, you know, few years of life and, you know, all the managed care is just, you know, outrageously expensive, you know, compared to, you know, the actual, you know, therapeutic development. If you can prevent it, you're going to, you know, save, you know, ultimately a lot more in the long run.
And if you look, so we've done some modeling, there's this kind of open question, like, how do you think about the longevity market? It's huge. It's obviously huge, but we actually try to put a number on it where if you look across the US population today, you can kind of bucket it into like, I die too early, or even though I live long enough, I'm still getting like weaker and less virile over time. And you basically lose, if you assume 120 is basically the top end of how long you can live, which is debatable, but I think there's pretty good evidence of that. But just leave that in place. You know, we lose around 8 billion life years to dying too early and an additional 2 billion life years to like getting weaker over time. And then if you extend everybody's life and then keep them very muscular the whole time, you get another 2 billion. So it's like 13 billion life years on the current population that's missing. You know, medical systems underwrite it like $100,000 per life year. Oh, but 800 million or 800 million of those life years are lost to accidents. So I can't save those, can't stop you. Like the robo taxis will have to prevent the car accidents. Net, 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 net. This is like a $1.3 quadrillion market. So it's the biggest one I've ever mentioned.
It's absolutely massive. And I agree with you to the point of like, you know, 120, I think is, you know, the kind of current estimates of what, you know, a human body could ultimately live to. I mean, it's like a car, you know, a car can only have, you know, so many miles put on it. And this is kind of, you know, the interesting thing we're thinking about is like, there's like the preventative piece that gets you to that 120. So you're avoiding, you know, kind of the four horsemen. You don't get cancer, you don't have diabetes, you're not overweight, you know, you get to that 120. But how do you actually, you know, regenerate, let's say, your heart to, you know, enable you to, you know, beat another 40 years longer? How do you ensure that your lungs have the capacity? I mean, there's things that ultimately give out, just like an engine in a car gives out. And similar to like ABS 201, how can we, you know, re-stimulate the stem cell growth within the follicle kind of elsewhere in the body to enable us to ultimately live past that 120 years and kind of get into this more of this regenerative longevity?
Yeah. And you kind of skated over it, but the 201 asset, it could, yes, grow more hair, but it also could like stop graying of hair and reverse graying, right? So, I mean, if I'm going to live that long, I want to have brown hair the whole way. I don't want to have to, you know, do the little dye in there or anything.
Oh, so. Yeah. No, I mean, it's incredible the pigmentation that comes back. And it all is because of you re-stimulating that stem cell. And that drives, you know, not only the follicle growth, but also the melanin and ultimately the pigmentation. And
so the pigmentation is the same hair color that the person would have grown up with. Yes.
Exactly. So you basically go from your gray colored hair to your naturally occurring hair color.
So Sean, is it going to come out in time to make you look less grizzled in your beard then?
Yeah. He looks distinguished, you know. Brett. Just stop.
Yes.
My dad had a sick burn on me the other day. He's like, wow, Sean, you're graying a lot faster than I ever did. I was like, damn, I obviously didn't get your biology.
Well, no, it's just he didn't get your market. Yes, the biotech market is like a recipe for premature graying.
Yeah, but 201, it'll be fun to see everyone go back to their naturally colored hair and actually have hair. And, you know, and it's really interesting. I mean, you know, why people pay for Ozempic out of pocket is, you know, because it's an identity piece. You know, weight and how we look is, you know, fundamental to who we are. And same with hair. Hair is a part of our identity, and being able to have that hair, you know, ultimately makes us feel more and more confident, you know, dare I say more sexy. Like we, you know, it's just a, you know, who we are, and people are willing to pay out of pocket to ultimately get their identity back. And I think like hair and weight are, you know, a part of that.
Sean, so just out of curiosity, where do you think if this did scale into a much broader regenerative medicine and therefore scaled, enjoyed the economies of scale, where could you see the new hair color being priced, or the old hair color coming back being priced?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like the way we're looking at pricing of this, you know, once it's approved is somewhere between, you know, what you'd pay for a Botox to kind of a hair transplant. And the great part is, at least what we're seeing in the NHP, the non-human primate study, is that once you turn the follicle on, it stays in that state for anywhere from 2 to 6 years based on your biology. And so we see it as actually being pulse therapy. So you're on the drug for 6 months, and then you go off drug for, you know, let's say 1 to 3 years, and then you go back on the drug. And so we see it as kind of pulse therapy and a very durable drug. And so, you know, if you're able to, you know, get your hair, you know, back for a couple of years for, you know, less than a hair transplant, we see that as a huge win for the ultimate consumer.
Okay, how much is
a hair transplant run?
Yeah.
We're trying to get to the number.
Yes. Anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to $10,000. So $10,000 is kind of the lower end of a hair transplant.
Okay, got that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like you price, it's like if I do this for a decade, maybe I'm getting up to $10,000, but I'm paying in $2,000 installments or $3,000 installments, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing is that like you could actually have it kind of be almost like a subscription if you wanted over that period of time. there's a lot of, I think, interesting kind of business models that you could ultimately do with this type of product.
Yeah, it's like I subscribe for hair, I subscribe for muscle.
You know, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Sean, it has been a pleasure and always good to hear about kind of the direction that AI and biotech is going. You're at the leading edge and we really appreciate the work that you're doing.
Yeah. You're epitomizing the most profound application of AI, and it's really exciting. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kathy and Brett. It's always fun to come on the podcast here.
From ARK Invest, this has been FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Please like, subscribe, rate us 5 stars on the platform of your choice. One of those 3-star middle-of-the-road ratings, por favor. And follow me on X at Winton Ark. Send any comments there and I'll like try to incorporate them into the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Sean and Kathy. I do think that drug discovery driven by AI is gonna work. I think that we will say, oh my gosh, this is a great application of these new AI models, is to, you know, put together kind of lab in the loop proprietary data to drive better outcomes in drug discovery. I think Absci is well positioned to capitalize on that. It has been a challenging couple of years in biotech generally, and I think that's disproportionately hurt the AI drug discovery companies that have been, you know, earlier in their journey of getting to commercialization. And so, as with, you know, if you look at the history of drug development and kind of other novel target areas, typically the market doubts it until it gets to commercialization and then suddenly realizes it has to pay full freight. What's interesting about AI drug discovery is paying full freight just be for the individual commercialized asset, but it should ramify into an assessment of the actual value of the platforms where, hey, they've used this model to get this drug to market less expensively and to commercialize. How is somebody else going to rebuild that model to compete with them? They'll have to go through the same pain and agony that Absci went through. And so there is a momentum that could build for these AI drug discovery platforms that allows them to grow, you know, quite large in relatively short order. And we will see. I mean, drug discovery is a process that is, you know, riven by unexpected failures, bad data readouts, things that go sideways. So it'll be an interesting space to watch over the next, you know, 12 and 24 months. Hope you enjoyed the program. Again, send us some comments, some likes, some subscriptions. Thanks for joining FYI.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.